Okay, it's my pleasure to introduce Zsolt, who will speak about insulators and metals.
Yeah, thank you. So there are other words in my title. quantization, optical responses, and there's no spin and no heat. But there will be some spin at the end, so maybe I can wake up when that happens. Wake you up when that happens. And there's actually hidden heat in it, but maybe I won't get into that because I'm mostly going to focus on metals because I think it's going to be, judging by the discussion level that have been happening, I won't get to insulators. So I'm going to start with the metallic stuff, which I'm very excited about. And since we had this gravitational anomaly and heat transport discussion, maybe I don't feel that bad. Okay, so I'm going to talk about quantization. And it's something that if you've been to the cell energetics colloquium, it's something that I also consider, in this case, it's kind of the condensed matter version of taking things for granted. So, you know, I'm still a bit puzzled by it, and I'm kind of obsessed to find places where you find responses where they should be continuous, but instead they're discrete. So, of course, we know the quantum Hall effect, and that's a linear response of insulators. That's just represented here is the off-diagonal response to an electric field. And it actually, you can also probe it in topological insulators by shining light. We're not going to get into the details, but that's another way of probing the Hall quantization of the surface conductivity. So, but my point here is that it's not often observed, or put in other ways, we always observe the Hall effect in a way. Now, it also raises the question, well, this is part of what this, the part of my talk that deals with insulators is actually going to have to do with measuring the Hall effect in a kind of interesting way, and that's will be my point at the end. But you can raise the question of, can we observe quantization beyond linear response and in metals? And this is going to be the first part of my talk. And it's admittedly already I'm going to throw out there that it's not going to be as robust as the quantum Hall effect, but it's still, I think, it's an interesting observation. So let's go to it. Now, one thing you have to notice, and a difference between this object here and this object here, is that it has two electric fields attached to it, so it has different symmetry properties. It has to have different symmetry properties to exist. So the electric field is odd and they're inversion, so two electric fields are even, but the current is odd. So you can only put a tensor here that's odd and they're inversion to have this effect. So it only happens in materials that break inversion. Now, it's going to happen in materials that we call viosemi metals, and many of you probably have heard of them, but let me just put everybody in the same page. So they're materials where two bands cross, and these are two non-degenerate bands, so they cannot really, you cannot really lift this crossing in this 2x2 subspace, and they're also monopoles of the Berry curvature. So what I mean by this is that if you take the Berry curvature of a band and you calculate the flux that encloses this vial node, you get a number that we call the monopole charge. It's kind of a Chern number, if you want. Now, these have to come in pairs because, well, you know, if you want something that's periodic in K, so here I'm plotting E, energy, and K, if you want something that's periodic in K, this is going out and this is going in, so if you just had something that's going out, this wouldn't be periodic. Now, so they usually come in pairs, and in most materials, actually, if you have transversal symmetry, most materials have also mirror symmetry, and actually, if you worked it out, what happens is that these two nodes of opposite chirality happen at the same energy. And so whatever you do to one, typically you do to the other, and if you have an effect that depends on the chirality, then it will cancel out. Now, you can try to break these mirrors, and actually, I'll mention some materials that do this, and put the vials at different energies, and that's going to be the whole trick. I'm going to try to access optically one, or theoretically, optically the one of the vial nodes and leave the other inactivated or polyblocked. So this is kind of the schematic picture. I will come here with a certain frequency and then excite electrons and then try to find a quantity that's quantized, but only probes the Chern number or the monopole charge of one of the vial nodes. So for that, I need to break all mirrors. However, I don't need to have time reversal, although it makes things simpler. So this is why I need chiral materials, chiral meaning that we break all mirrors, and that's why they're chiral, kind of like a, if you want, a screw that you screw in your house. Okay, so let's say you can isolate this part of the response, of the nonlinear response, the second order response, in a material that breaks inversion. You might do this by shining light and measuring, either putting contacts and measuring the current directly, or you can also try to measure the far field generated pulse, or the reflected pulse generated by this current, which is typically actually what experimentalists do more often. Now, probably you're not experts. If you are, tell me. Probably you're not experts on second order optical responses. I wasn't either. But this is kind of a schematic picture of what can happen. So if you shine some pulse of frequency omega zero, then essentially it can interfere constructively with itself and create a pulse that oscillates at double the frequency, so it's second harmonic generation. Or it can interfere destructively and generate a pulse that does not oscillate at all. So that's DC photocurrent. That's only possible if you have nonlinear responses, right? Because if you have a linear response, it will always oscillate with the external field.
So what's I omega, sorry?
It's just the intensity. Yeah, it's just a... it's just the electric field squared, let's say. Yeah. So it's just the profile of the pulse, if you want.
Yeah. I assume it's something about the polarization of the
electric field. I will in a second, yes. So I'm going to actually focus on the DC response. And within this, you can separate into two polarizations. So you're anticipating my next slide. And depending on that, I'll call it shift current or injection current. So the shift current is what's really kind of the zero frequency counterpart of second harmonic generation. So you can use this to make solar cells, let's say. So you create a DC current from oscillating light. But you can also think of the part of the tensor that's sensitive to the reversed. Sorry about that. So that's sensitive to the elicity of the light. Now, what my claim is going to be is that there's a part of this nonlinear coefficient, a nonlinear response function that actually is quantized in units of E cubed over H squared instead of E squared over H. Yeah.
But you're assuming that the electric fields that you're using are so weak that you are not really changing the distribution.
I will be exciting electrons from yeah. So I'm still considering that their effect is perturbative, but I'm going to second order.
Yeah.
So they can. Like in particular, they could enter like the occupation number,
yeah.
Which is yeah.
Okay,
so that okay. In that sense, they do. Yeah.
How about unpolarized light? Because to make a photocell.
Yeah. Unpolarized. So this would be the shift current, but I'm not going to talk about it. So if you want to enhance photocells, you would have to enhance this so that when you average over polarization, you get a finite current. But this you can do. It's just that not the center of my talk.
That shift current community, which has been around since Soviet Union. Mm-hmm.
Yes. Yeah.
They served in Kozinski claiming in 1970s that in order to get another shift current mm-hmm. in response to unpolarized light, you can see this in the view of by and you know that you need a non-zero polarization. In other words, that's why the Soviet Russians were always looking at ferroelectrics.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, what is your current understanding of that issue?
The current.
It's really possible to get the photocurrent without having a ferroelectric. And all the Russian papers are so focused on ferroelectrics.
Yes. Yeah, and there's also actually a huge debate on what's the scattering effects on this photocurrents as well.
Yeah, they have this other mechanism.
Yeah, so I think the current status is too long to summarize in an answer to a question in a talk, but it's definitely not closed, I would say. So.
But you need non-center symmetry.
Yeah, you need to break it. Yeah.
You need to break inversion.
Yeah, that's.
And then if it's not, then you can get a polarization too, right?
That's reasonable. You see, there is you have to break some symmetry, but the question is symmetry of what? You can break symmetry of material, such as inversion symmetry, or you could break symmetry of the device, because applying a time-dependent field into the Hamiltonian, it doesn't matter whether it's light or data like the rotor, so all the systems are the same. how do you get current out of tiny Benham hematoma in general?
Okay.
In the case of light, if the light is amplified, to make it practical, because it's a
Can I have a feeling that
But I'm happy to discuss these topics. I mean, this is actually very important, I think. And we have experience, and I'll get back to that, of finding very good and old Russian papers that people have ignored. So I can relate to that. But yeah, again, my talk is basically on circular polarization, so in principle.
Sorry, yeah. Clarification. Mm-hmm. So at this point, these responses exist if you break the inversions.
Yes. Yeah.
But you said that you need to break the mirror symmetry to put files.
Yes. Yeah.
So which of those
So far I haven't specified to that. So basically, what that does is make some components of this object zero if you put mirrors. I'll get to that in a second, and then you can tell me if I answer your question. Okay, so which is here. So this part is called the injection current. Is what measures. It was what knows about. It's the current that changes sign when you flip polarization, and you can kind of combine the or write in a way that's explicit. So that's this E cross E star that tells you that's basically the plane. This J points in the direction perpendicular to the plane of polarization, and now you can isolate a part of this sigma that so far I haven't introduced this order will diverge as 1/(ω), and just naively, just since you're not gonna do the calculation right now live. Just naively think that this guy has a 1/(ω), and so I can put this omega to the other side and go to the time domain, and this would turn out to be a dj dt. So it's a linearly increasing current that is DC, so it's not oscillating. And then in between, there's a tensor that in general depends on the frequency that tells you where is the current flowing with respect to the plane of polarization, essentially. And here's where the symmetry comes in. So which elements of this tensor are allowed? And in fact, this is allowed in gyrotropic materials. But for the effect in particular that I want, I'm going to be looking at the trace of this object. And this trace of this object is only possible if you have this trace of this tensor is only non-zero if you break all mirrors. So if you have some enantiomorph, essentially, if your crystal structure has some chirality to it. Like you can think of the atoms kind of arranged in a screw manner, for example. And so what we found is that this trace of beta is actually given by exactly the flux of the Berry curvature over the transitions, over the optical transitions. So the optical transitions, the transitions between, let's say, the valence band and the conduction band, are allowed if they are separated by h/(ω), and this defines some surface in momentum space that I call S. And so this trace of this tensor measures the flux over the Berry curvature over this surface. Now here's a caveat: this result is only exact for two-band models. And so now we can go into the details how robust this is. But let me just for the moment focus on two-band models, and then explain to you what happens if you add more bands, and then add this order.
Okay, so there are two wild points, right?
Yes.
So this surface is like two spheres.
Yeah. So this is my next slide actually. So imagine this material, for example. In the low energy subspace, it has two vials of opposite chirality separated in energy. So what would happen is that if I come with light and hit if at zero frequency, basically nothing will happen. At small frequency, only one would be activated, and will give you it would give you a plateau essentially, because it only depends.
Where's the Fermi level?
The Fermi level is at zero.
Okay.
So actually, let me show it. So here's the trace of this beta in units of some constant that's basically e cubed over h squared. Now this. Times pi. Now this quantity as a function of frequency does the following. So at zero frequency or small frequency, both nodes are blocked because I cannot excite particles from let's say, lower band, the lower band to the upper band, so you get zero. Now, at some frequency, which is non-universal and depends on the chemical potential, you activate the node and get a universal result. But this plateau keeps going until some other non-universal value of the frequency, which is the activation of the second node. And then it drops off and eventually dies off to zero.
And what is the direction of current?
So your sine is sort of like,
yeah, it goes in.
It goes along Z, right?
Yeah, along Z. That's why it's a 3D, let's say, response, because you're rotating something in this plane and you're getting current in this direction.
You exploit anomaly, you change the distribution functions and you populate the state it propagates. You change the relative position of state it propagates in
yes,
the environment.
Absolutely, yeah, exactly. And you're allowed to do that because you broke inversion in the first place.
Which Berry phase is it? Because you have a conduction on those.
Yeah, so that's where having two bands is important. So in two band models, the two are related. It's just one minus the other. One is minus the other, right? Like if I have
integrals
are
related.
The Berry curvature.
The Berry curvature is just equal and opposite.
Yeah.
So can I speak? So I appreciate that there is a source of this current that comes from popping.
Mm-hmm.
But if there is a relaxation between the two wild points, like in Spivak's law, which I guess you know better than me, would it degrade its effectiveness?
Yes, so I'll go back to the question of relaxation later, which is very important. And it does affect experiments. So for the moment, I'm just trying to paint the picture without scattering, and then we'll go back to that.
Is it the current or it's electromotive force, so to speak, that it's the source that I have to take to put into the kinetic equation?
Mm-hmm. Ah. I would say it's a current, but then it can degrade, let's say it can saturate.
Well, go to zero.
I would say saturate, yeah. Yeah, I would say saturated. But I'll go back to the effect of the disorder because I don't think this is at all understood, in fact. But anyway,
which range of frequency do you consider?
Yes, so this is very important. So you need to find a material where the difference between these two frequencies is observable, right? It's large enough so that you can actually observe this effect. So here is around 0.1 eV, which is, it's definitely within the range one could observe. And actually, I will show you experiments in a few slides.
But is there a limit of validity of this theory for a certain range of frequency of the drive?
Yeah, I guess, let's see. So, I guess the parameter that matters is
okay, drive over. The
yeah,
device.
Drive over exactly. Yeah, yeah. So then, as long as you're in the perturbative regime, in that
so
I would say, yeah,
you keep
it's like linear response, but to next order in a way. So if you're in that regime, then it's valid. If not, then not. Yeah.
Do you use like the results of Floquet equation to calculate that?
You can get to the same result using Floquet. Yeah, but that's in this paper if you want to read it. Yeah. Now, what I want to get to is that actually there are some corrections to this quantization, which are due to extra bands. So if you don't have a two-band model, now you can prove or you can show that the corrections actually scale with the frequency in a way that with the one over the distance in energy to the other bands, meaning that if the extra bands are very far away, then they don't matter that much. If they're like at the Fermi level, then this correction would diverge and you wouldn't see quantization. And so this is, another way of saying this is that there's a matrix element times this type of correction. Now, and this led us to say that, well, if you have extra bands crossing this nodal point, we wrote that we are not expected to see quantization if you have extra bands. So there are materials in particular that, like rhenium silicon, that have, instead of two bands, they have three bands crossing at the same point, or four bands here. You don't see them because some of them are degenerate, but there are three and four here. And these are protected by extra crystalline symmetries. Now, this would, like if this, so the authors of this paper pointed out that they just calculated the CPG and they found a plateau. And it wasn't clear whether this plateau was quantized or not, or why would this correction not matter. turns out, we try to address this question in this other paper, which I'll spare you the details, but the main conclusion is that if you have a Hamiltonian that looks like this, which is just linear in momentum, and it has some sort of spin matrix attached to it, but it doesn't necessarily have to be a spin matrix, it's just for particular values of this parameter that's a spin matrix, then there's values of frequencies where essentially this matrix elements goes to zero. Because you know, if you're highly symmetric, let's say very close to the to this threefold crossing, you will see that this correction is actually vanished by symmetry. And if that's the case, then there's a window of frequencies again, which is quite large. If you see it, it's like from zero to point, I don't know, 0.4 or something like this, where you could see where you could see again this effect. So this and kind of this. Well, this result actually, you know, increased the number of materials that could display this effect because we at first we were just looking at two-band crossings. Now we can look at more bands that cross. So we had to we were just too careful in our first paper, and we had to correct it a bit in the second paper.
Sir, may I ask you a question?
Yes.
So if you just take a totally mundane material, I don't know, copper or whatever, so are you expecting to see zero if you have
Yeah, so I mean. Copper doesn't break inversion, right?
So, or whatever. So, let's take a material which is conventional metal, but let's break inversion. Yeah. I'll apply pressure, whatever.
Yeah. Yeah, so, for example.
So, but is it not a metal?
It is some metal.
And if you cross a bunch of other bands, then that make it a metal, essentially?
Well, I'm saying that just from conventional ENM, one has to have more or less transparent medium for this effect, right? So.
But in this thing, whatever that, I don't know what these noodles mean, but they seem to cross a large appearance surface, right?
Yes.
This is actually metal.
Yes.
So how is it different from, well,
copper? Well, it's different that the density vector is smaller.
Okay, wait, so actually.
What?
From this one is different.
So
different
in
from what? Like so not 10,000 Kelvin?
So there are several answers to that question. So you need to break inversion and mirrors, okay? Now, if you're worried about the Fermi surface, actually, so in linear response, you have you know that you have a Drude peak, that's you know important if you have a good metal and interband transitions. Now you can ask the same question, and I'll go back to that at the end. You can ask the same question: what is the Fermi surface contribution to this nonlinear effect, to this CPD? So remember, you're subtracting left and right polarizations. So this Drude peak is always gone. So.
No, but I'm just trying to say, so say you do have a metal, you break your symmetries, okay?
Yes.
You're not allowed to do that. Right?
Yes,
but
yeah,
not
yeah.
To have wild metal.
So generically, you would have, if you break, let's say, inversion and mirrors, and you have a normal metal, you get something in the diagonal that is not quantized.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Okay. Great.
You seem to say that you see nothing, right?
No? Copper.
Well, copper
is not a good one.
Actually, sort of follow up on that. So if the density. How does the light get in if the density is high?
Yeah, so you need to think into account that, and this is something that's been kind of worked out. I mean, you want to measure this reflectivity, then you need to take into account the absorption of the material. Because if you, for example, let's say in second harmonic generation, you shine light and then release a pulse that is double the frequency, but you absorb at that frequency, you're not going to see it unless you take in, unless the absorption is small at that frequency. But the thing is, in vials and also in these materials, which is something that Miguel Angel here worked out, is that the linear conductivity is linear in frequency. So it's actually not that, like if you put the numbers, it's actually not that bad. So, and in fact, you can actually do this experiment, as I'll show in a second.
I guess the worry is more than absorption. The worry is that if you're below the plasma frequency, you're not actually going into the sample very much. You just get reflected.
Yeah, but actually,
so you're seeing most of the surface.
Yeah, that doesn't seem to matter that much in experimenting, actually. Yeah.
I mean,
then I'm returning to Victor's question. Suppose I take beryllium, where we know there is a surface state
exactly.
That breaks the symmetry, and I squeeze it to break the mirror.
Mm-hmm.
Will I see the same effect?
The thing is, also you need to take into account where is the current oriented. So if it's coming from a surface state, then it's a 2D thing and it'll never. Yeah.
Because it needs to go.
Yeah, it needs to go.
So
it
decay
yeah.
Is proportional
yeah.
To the surface state.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
So
exactly. Yeah.
Well, I guess you're measuring a current.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Good. This is great.
So the standard shift current is again, the solid paper defines the insulating system, the conductor.
Ah, yeah, okay, yes.
So imagine now, I take the usual model people study to get that effect, which is the Rice-Mellon model.
Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm, yeah. It's the 1D. And then I close the gap. Mm-hmm. So I can close the gap.
You just fine-tune the parameters.
Well, I can just put electrodes and inject evanescent wave functions. Okay. And fill up the gap with the evanescent density states. And so then I would have a metal for all practical purposes, same as what these guys are asking, which is like copper, but this one would break inversion.
Yeah.
So what would you then expect in terms of current versus frequency dependent?
Yeah, so you would have, so in that case, you would have terms that also come from the Fermi surface. So there would be a Fermi surface contribution. But actually, that Fermi surface contribution that I will get to, maybe, is that it actually has peaks. So it just, you know, you take your material, you calculate all the terms that depend on, you know, all the second-order response, and then you see what you get. But then, you know, you can get resonances due to the fact that you have a Fermi surface or not, and it just depends on the material. Yeah.
So the reason why I'm asking, because in this case, and this is kind of very interesting, what you're getting is there is a current which is proportional to omega, that's your Planck's current, and then there's the second current.
No, it's not proportional. It's actually flat in omega.
Oh, it's flat.
Yeah. So that was the previous slide. Whoa. So it's you see it's completely flat. And this value is only determined by universal constant.
The derivative is flat.
The derivative of the current is flat. Yeah. So it's like increase. Sorry. Yeah. So it's like, yeah.
But you're dividing the current by what to get conductance? I need to divide it by some energy.
Yeah. So that's what Jay was saying, that it's actually an increase of a DC current. So that's why it's called injection current. I'll have a plot maybe in a few slides.
Because, for example, in that Rice-Mellon model which I mentioned, what you would get is the same thing that you see in standard pumping from 20 years ago in mesoscopic physics, which is that I can either have adiabatic pumping proportional to omega, or I can have non-adiabatic pumping proportional to omega squared, depending on what kind of symmetries I'm breaking. So this result then violates those rules, and it's very interesting actually, because you are saying you get the result which does not depend on omega, and that thing does not exist in the standard mesoscopic.
Okay, I'm not familiar enough with the paper.
Power's pumping.
Yeah, okay, that I'm
familiar
with. It's pumping, it's a dissipative effect alone. It's a dissipative effect, it has zero relation pumping to zero. No relation.
Which one?
This one. It's a dissipative effect, dissipative. You change the distribution of particles. It's not a derivative. Adiabatic changes current, changes sign is a negative sign. Here the current doesn't change sign, you can have it's just different. Okay, so it's a dissipative effect.
Yeah, that's correct.
But I'm saying, but pumping means you take it in Newtonian and you put a time dependent field inside. So
okay.
You drive a car.
You should interfere in this.
Okay. I'm gonna take that interference to continue. Okay, great.
Thanks for the confusion. Our speaker can continue.
Yeah. No, but these are great points. I would like to continue discussing on this. But okay, so we had a prediction. We just took a tie binding model based on the symmetries of this material and others, and then just calculated a tie binding model, many bands, and you get something that's not exactly quantized due to this matrix elements that I was mentioning, but it's close to, in this case, 4, which is the Chern number of this threefold null crossing. Now, disorder. Okay, I feel this is going to also spark discussions. if a clean system sparks discussion, that's already, I'm already happy. You know, it's,
what is
the
SO and OSO?
Spin orbit and no spin orbit, yeah. It matters a bit because this thing splits and you have other extra transitions and this is, you know, the matrix elements are, some matrix elements that weren't allowed before are allowed before, so the quantization is a bit worse. And you'll see next in the DFT that it actually makes a difference, yeah. This is just a tie binding, it's a very like naive tie binding model, so.
Sorry, I'm confused, but if this is an observable, you somehow assume that your distribution function is one to the Fermi level. Like, did you account for the changes in the distribution function?
Well, I'm taking changes of the distribution function order by order. So okay. To that order is one. That's
yeah.
It. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. So yeah, this is what I was saying before. The effect we're discussing is an increase in DC current as a function of time. And so if I plot the current as a function of time, it will kind of increase with a, let's say, quantized slope. And now if I add this order, then at a typical scattering time, it will saturate. And the problem is that it will saturate on a value that does depend on the scattering time, obviously. And this is something non-universal. So you would have to, if you do the experiment slower, then you would have to take, you have to estimate what the scattering time is to actually find this quantized value.
Excuse me, what scattering time is that? Is that internodal, or it doesn't matter?
It doesn't really matter, yeah. I think it's any scattering time that can relax the current. So I think even intranode scattering will do this. Because you're talking about
intranodal transport scattering time.
Yeah. Okay, so then we did a more complete calculation, and this is related to Enrico's question. So this was our original time binding. The display of the plots is a bit funny because I wanted to keep the quantization at the same level and the zero at the same level. So this is Yang Zhang actually did a great job in doing calculating this nonlinear optical response by first principles, and he came out with this two curves where you see that in fact lower than this time binding model, which is 0.25, it actually drops down. It has this dip, so the matrix elements start mattering a lot. In fact, now. Earlier this year, Joe Orenstein's group in Berkeley measured this effect, and they did it in a way where they had to estimate the scattering time. So they did that as well, and they plotted this curve. So this is beta tau now. Beta is this coefficient, this trace, so this nonlinear coefficient times tau, because they say their pulse is not fast enough to resolve this increase in current. Now, if you do that, what they find is that in their units, this 4 is the same as this 1. They find basically that this overshoots a bit and that actually goes down. So it really looks a lot like this DFT calculation, which is actually quite pleasantly surprising for me. Yeah.
So the estimate,
yes, that's
it. It's
very complicated. And then we go into another subtlety of this field, which is how do you estimate tau? And that's what motivated my next work. But to answer your question, they looked at, you can look at several things, but you need the hot tau. You need the exactly what you're saying, right? So they looked at the DC, also they looked at DC response. They looked at linear optical conductivity, how broadened that is. And with that, they found some tau that, but you know, the point here is that right now, I think the status of the field is that we need something that doesn't care about this tau, because the tau is so hard to estimate that we need. So that's our next proposal. Yeah.
You have a question? So at low frequency, the quantization is not so good because omega tau is not large, right?
Yeah, I think essentially you're going into a regime. We also get into the subtleties of these materials, but basically you get into a regime where these matrix elements that I was telling you about matter a lot, and then this kind of drops down.
So it's not because of disorder, it's for other orders.
Yeah, it's even if you had a clean sample, this will show up. Actually, this calculation is for a clean sample. Yeah.
But can you just measure, you know, the previous plot, you showed the slope? Can
yeah.
The slope is quantized.
Right. So the problem with that is that you have to shine a pulse that is fast enough to faster than the scattering time of your material, and that's what's hard. Yeah. But it's in principle possible. It's actually terahertz pulses in a picosecond regime. It's actually not that. So you have to find a material clean enough that. But I think so. There are two problems here. One is that, and the other one is that the material itself has these matrix elements that make it more complicated. So there's still a need of finding a vial material with two vial nodes separated in energy, which we don't have yet actually.
How is the current measured?
It's measured by the Yeah, it's measured by basically, so you shine this pulse and it generates a current, and this current generates a reflected pulse in a way. And then you measure the far field electric field and you translate that into a current. So it's a very, very complicated experiment, and it's really amazing.
Would this clear why it's quantized, at least in your model?
In this model? Well, okay, so it's not exactly quantized because of these matrix elements, but the point is that if you take like the simplest model, the simplest three-fold crossing, so three bands crossing, then you can think of it being as spin minus one, zero, and one. And so the matrix elements between the you know, you're coming with circular polarized light, so you can change your angular momentum by one unit. And so the matrix elements between minus one and one are forbidden. And so this brings you back to the two-band problem, essentially. So it's a kind of a miracle in a way in this material. Yeah.
I think the point of view is that they basically redistribute electrons by light. Mm-hmm. Then the rate of this process depends on matrix elements.
Yes.
And then you're telling me that the matrix element is something in universal quantity.
Sometimes, yeah. Depends.
I'm just wondering why is it. I'm not saying it's wrong, but I just wonder how.
Yeah.
How
so
it happens at that matrix element.
Yeah. I mean, that's why we at first, like in our first work, we said that this could not happen. But then it turns out that this dispersions are very special. This linear dispersions that have some sort of spin structure, the matrix elements inherit this spin structure, and so that's how eventually you recover, let's say, the two band result, because some of the matrix elements are forbidden or very small. Yeah. So they're not exactly quantized. I mean, that's a point.
The fact that there are block functions which you don't know that matter. If arithmetic elements, it also put block functions, mm-hmm. which are some horrible functions, of course.
Yeah. So that matters, I think, away from the crossing. So from the crossing, if you want, the crystal symmetries of your material are imposing this that if you're close enough to this nodal point, you're essentially recovering rotational invariance, and this makes the matrix elements very small.
Maybe just another way of saying, you can do KRP around the crossing points,
yes.
Right? Then you go on.
Yeah. Sorry, yeah, this was a very long way of saying that.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, sorry. Okay. So this is my solution, or our solution, to the scattering time problem. Let's do a different experiment, which involves two. Light pulses. It's actually not that exotic. It has a name before we studied it, difference frequency generation. And it's trying to look for the signal that oscillates with the difference in the frequency of the two lights, of the two light pulses. Now, to be in a regime where the scattering time doesn't matter, you need to assume the following things. So you have to assume that the sum of those frequencies is the largest energy scale, then comes the difference of these frequencies, and then comes the scattering time. And so in principle, you can do this. And if you calculate the response, then you'll get something like this for the circular part. Here, this expression assumes time reversal, but you don't really need to. But it's just to simplify. And going back to Russian papers, so many of these things were already calculated, obviously, by Genkin and Mednis. And also, they have a very interesting discussion on scattering. Scattering. That's why at first we were like, OK, let's try to figure out what scattering really does. But then that seems like a very complicated problem. That we might attack in the future, but this seemed an easier solution for experimentalists, which is to look at the, basically if you measure the current, now you can look at the part of the current that goes in phase or out of phase of your pulse, or in phase or out of phase of your pulse, and measure exactly the same coefficient, so this beta, will reduce to, it's exactly the same expression as I was explaining before. So this is a circular photogalvanic effect. But also it comes with an extra perk, which is the fact that you can isolate the free carrier contribution. So this tensor encodes everything that depends on having a Fermi surface, which goes back to Victor's question. Now, it turns out, and this was part of what was derived in these old works, is that this free carrier contribution is actually the k derivative of the integrand of the reactive part of the linear conductivity. So this is a very complicated sentence, but basically think of this as the Hall effect. So take the Hall conductivity expression, take the integrand of that, derive with respect, differentiate that with respect to K, and you'll get exactly this piece. And so it turns out that with this experiment, you can measure quantization, but also you can measure what is different between metals and insulators in this effect. And so we have a few examples. So here's tantalum arsenide, a material that one wouldn't have quantization. So you see this thing does whatever. And you have this Fermi surface enabled contribution, but it's not a zero frequency response. So it has many peaks depending on where the nodes activate, and same for rhodium silicon. So there's a lot of structure in this nonlinear effects, not only at zero frequencies. Okay, so now here's my spin. So if you like spin and you hate optics, here's a slide for you. Or how we can talk, basically. So if you take, let's say you take a metal that breaks inversion, you're allowed to have the following dispersion. It's basically a Rashba type of splitting where the two spins are split in K. Now, imagine you can fill one of those spins more than the other. So this you need to do some spin injection, or like there's clever ways of doing this even in experiment, as this paper showed. But let me say you can do this. Now the scattering processes are going to be asymmetric. So namely, like this orange arrows are going to make the populations of these two spin differences, and you can get a current. And this is called the spin galvanic effect, and it's an old thing that was even realized in gallium arsenide and measured experimentally. But it has the following structure. So it also has a scattering time in front. There's a real electric current. Proportional to a tensor that it's allowed in gyrotropic point groups, and it has the electron spin here. Now, if you look at my expression, or the expression I showed for the Sikora photogalvanic effect, it's actually exactly the same physically, because it's also allowed in gyrotropic point groups, and it involves what is the photon angular momentum. So it really, this guy and this guy really transform the same way. So this is to say, and this is just in the spirit of KADP and throwing something that I don't understand really that well, is to say that maybe there's something interesting here in this that it's interesting for the spin community. So I think with that, I'm going to use a trick which I learned from my student, which is a fade to black. And thank you for your attention.
Flash the conclusions.
More questions.
And the end.
So I have a question. So
yes.
For calculating this beta, can you draw a diagram similar to anomaly diagram? Is there something like a triangle diagram that you have to calculate?
Yes, absolutely. So yeah.
What is in the vertices?
Well, there are two electric fields and one current. I mean,
that's literally the anomaly.
It's the same diagram, but it's not the anomaly.
So, okay, why? Can you explain?
Yes. So the anomaly. So when you calculate the anomaly, you calculate not the current really. You calculate the derivative of the current. So if you think of a diagram, yeah, maybe I can draw this. So. So let's say you have the current here, and then you have some two fields here, right? And you say, well, this looks a lot like the anomaly diagram, right? But in the anomaly diagram, you have this guy, right? You are calculating essentially, or maybe with a 5. But since I'm only looking at one node, let me just call it normal current. And then you calculate this and, yeah, somehow lead to this. So you're basically coming to this diagram and acting with an external momentum to. You're multiplying this diagram with an external momentum. So this kills a lot of terms in this diagram. So this
including the actual anomaly?
No, the actual anomaly is, this is exactly what you do to calculate the anomaly. You calculate this diagram, you say, I only care about the terms that survive when I hit it with a P external momentum. And one of the terms you kill is this one, is the CPG. So it's the same diagram, but it's not the anomaly.
But maybe the turn around, is there a nonlinear effect potentially one could think of that would actually be sensitive to anomalies?
Yes, and we were thinking about this. I mean, we yeah, we can talk in part. that's a theatrical effect.
You know the answer, but doesn't want to tell you.
So. And I don't want it to be recorded. Yeah.
An obvious question.
It is an obvious question. What's not obvious is the answer.
More questions, more
like you mentioned the spin dynamic effect, you can also have the inverse spin dynamic effect.
Yes.
Can you think of the inverse of your effect?
Good question. So I read those words yesterday about the inverse dynamic effect. you would think of, let's say, driving a current and turning if you, yeah, I mean.
Emitting
light. Yeah. I guess there's, yeah. There's an inverse.
So can you again clarify? I'm just trying to look at the paper, like, what is the current? There's a current coming out of the system when you shine light.
Yeah.
So what is the current proportional to when you look at the frequency?
So if you let's say, imagine, okay, if you have scattering, it's just tau times some constant times z squared.
It doesn't depend on frequency
no.
at all. But there is the Tomino square correction.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
But in the first order,
first
it's
order
really
is completely
independent.
Yeah. I mean, it has this tau dependence, but like if you do the experiment fast enough, then you don't care about the tau.
Because that's really fun.
I'm happy to hear it.
From the viewpoint of anything else that has ever been calculated, then
I mean, this is a very simple calculation, so I think.
I think, like, just when I look at other systems, you know, for example, many people in this room do spin pumping. So
yeah,
spin pumping, I have a magnetization processing at frequency omega, and if I look at what comes out of, I forget about what is inside, I just look at the black box. So if I have a magnetization processing, I will see spin current coming out, and that spin current will be proportional to omega.
Mm-hmm.
If I break some additional symmetries, I could get charge current coming out of the black box, but it will be proportional to omega squared, depending on what symmetries I'm breaking. So
right, are those linear effects, though? Are those linear effects? Because maybe that's why I get away with not having it.
Well, something proportional to omega is equivalent to linear response. Something
right.
proportional to omega squared is not a linear response. So, like, for example, in standard pumping theory, tau less than onward, there's a kind of mathematical theory that you know, mathematicians, which says that if I break the symmetry of the device, not the material, because eventually I have some
yeah,
electrons.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So if I have a two-terminal device, and I break left-right symmetry statically, then I'm going to get charge current proportional to omega squared.
I see.
If I break the symmetry dynamically, as was the case of the first experiment that Charlie Marcus tried with two gates, and that was considered to be kind of full of artifacts, but that's the basic idea, which is what you get from this Catherine Brower formula that people also use for spin pumping. So if I break the left-right symmetry of the device, left-right symmetry means like a mirror.
Yeah.
Put the plane, I have a left-right device going from minus to plus infinity in real space. And then I look through that plane, if I break the symmetry dynamically with time fields, then I will get current proportional to omega.
Mm-hmm.
And so in that sense, this result looks like a magic because it is still like a quantum system exposed to time-dependent potential, but it violates both of these theorems. So, and that would be like an interesting thing to check.
Yeah.
Why it doesn't, because by the way, we wrote a paper on this issue. And
can you close the question or answer?
No, I'm just saying we wrote a paper trying to explain that shift current can be actually put into one-to-one correspondence with the standard pumping examples.
I see, but this is not shift current, though. This is injection.
No, I'm saying, but.
Yeah, but maybe.
Again, forget about naming. Like, you take
yeah,
the box,
yes.
You put some material in the box, you attach it to a voltmeter, and then you shine light, or you apply microwave fields, or you put the gate electrodes. From theoretical viewpoint, what you have is the Newtonian plus V of omega, harmonic
yeah.
potential.
Yeah.
And then the generic question, which has nothing to do with whether it's Gauss elemental, you know, this or that, is what kind of current I'm going to get, if at all. Because electrons are always going to be dripped around by Lorentz kind of motion. But it doesn't mean that I'm going to get current out, because to get the current out, something has to be eventually then I integrate current over time, I have to see that something goes out of the system. Mm-hmm. And so in all of these examples that are pumping, of the pumping type from the old Taoist theory onward.
I think you're repeating what you just said, so maybe we can, you can.
Well, I'm saying it's very interesting topic because it's. Maybe you didn't know about this.
Why? Yeah, no, it's a fair point. I mean, I didn't.
Violates all these rules that you have been
I think it's worth, worth checking if it's everything's consistent. That's.
So from this perspective of looking optically, looking for chiral anomaly, I mean, I guess I'm wondering if the following is an example. I mean, you can just apply a magnetic field. Mm-hmm. I'm pretty sure that's been done also in this model. And then you chiral anomaly just says that if you have an electric field, you change the population.
Yeah.
And then you could probe that optically. So in principle, you could just have an electric field which is oscillating, and then probe it with another electric field.
Yeah.
And that would be also some version of nonlinear optical response in a magnetic field, no?
Yeah, I know some people have suggested to look at just linear conductivity. Like if you change the populations of the, if you have a steady state that has changed the populations of the two vials, then the Pauli blocking itself is just going to
exactly.
be linear. Yeah. So that has been proposed as well. Yeah. And I think I'm not sure, but there's definitely experiments going on. I'm not sure if they're on. But, okay. Yeah.
But that's some version. It feels like you need to be nonlinear to be definitive in that
yeah.
case.
Yeah, in a way it's a nonlinear effect because you apply B and E and then you kind of
exactly.
probe it with light. Yeah, so it's like E squared and B,
So you have a first probe and a second, and then you measure the outcome. So you always make the assumption, right, that the first probe is not really, for example, changing the topology of the system.
You mean in this case?
Yeah, because I could think that maybe I can shine light in circular polarized every time reverse asymmetry, and even if I'm in the small frequency limit, I could, for example, induce some band crossing at a certain intensity.
Yeah.
So the probe itself.
But the wouldn't the separation of the crossings be proportional to the intensity? Or?
I think it depends. But who's looking at this, I think it depends, right? Because a lot of time people look at frequencies that are, at least proportional to the gap. Mm-hmm. But if you start including, second order, third order, like if you think about second order effects, like if the frequency is half of the gap, then already a second order effect actually can create this blocking resonance in the system.
Right.
So you could actually just with the initial probe itself and maybe change something,
mm-hmm.
right? And then, so what you measure is, if it's like this change or what you had before was the time scales. Of
I'm assuming that the probe does not change the properties
change
of the system.
Yeah.
I think that's an assumption of just linear response, or nonlinear in this case,
it's
but just perturbative.
This is a small thing. So I think you have to assume some form, at least when we looked at it, you needed to assume some small scattering, extra scattering mechanism, like some relaxation mechanism so that these nonlinear effects, like higher orders don't just come in without, for the perturbation series to be valid in some sense.
Yeah.
So at least for the shift current angle, this is true.
Okay.
For the shift current.
Yeah, the scattering time issue is definitely a delicate thing. So,
Have you tried to look maybe at the distribution of electrons and write down some kinetic equation with phones, try to understand if things are relaxing?
Yeah, so I haven't done that myself, but some people have done. People have looked at more like semi-classical response theory to second order, let's say. But this is a bit outside of that because you need interband transitions. So semi-classics is more like how you move a weight packet in a way. So.
But anyway, in your systems, you never have the gap to start with.
I do not. Yeah,
that's
right.
Yeah, it's something close.
Any more? No? Okay, let's take a look over here.